From Public Radio International, I'm Madeline Brand, and this is America Abroad. Populism is sweeping through Europe.
The whole Brexit process really did uncork something in Britain.
And it's changing the political conversation, especially when it comes to Muslim immigration.
What this kind of new wave of anti-Muslim racism has done has brought to the table a legitimized form of racism, one that they feel that is totally justified by a mainstream narrative that depicts Muslims as the fifth column.
In some cases, these populist movements are also fueling extremist violence against immigrants.
During the attack, they were shouting that they are going to kill us and they're going to burn us.
Backlash, Europe's far right, and Muslim migration, next on America Abroad. First, this news. From Public Radio International, this is America Abroad, the show that brings global issues home. I'm Madeline Brand. Thorsten Vogt lives in Celle, Germany. It's a quaint town near Hanover. He owned and operated a campground until his business was condemned for safety regulations.
It's a disgrace what they have done to us. They arrived at 3 p.m. and told us to be off the camping site by 7 p.m. They had a bunch of police officers in tow. So we said, let's get out of here in an orderly way. We don't want to get into trouble.
Hard times are a reality for Thorsten and for many other Germans. Though Germany's economy is booming, he doesn't see much evidence of that in his own life. The top 10% of the country controls most of the wealth, and a fifth of Germans are hovering near the poverty line, Thorsten among them. He and his wife live on welfare and receive a small pension. He's learned to live with less, but he gets angry when he thinks others may be receiving more.
I cannot walk into a mobile phone shop and buy a phone for 700 euro in cash. If I tried to do that, my welfare worker would flip me the bird. I have witnessed it myself. I stood next to a foreigner, I think from Syria. He had a bundle of cash, 100 euro bills and 500 euro bills.
While it's true many immigrants receive welfare benefits, they don't get more than native-born Germans. Thorsten doesn't believe that. He's also suspicious of other things.
You hear the stories about the women. For some refugees, the German women are fair game. That's the way it is. I believe that there are assaults on women. Some of the stories may be fake, but I think a large share of the stories are true.
There have been some isolated attacks, but immigrants going after women, it's not a widespread problem. Still, it's a potent idea. Anatoly Trenkenshu is a city councilman in Celle and a member of the far-right Alternative for Germany party. It's known as the AFD. And they've been winning seats by capitalizing on the fears of people like Thorsten.
The topic of mass immigration, which we have here, has, I suppose, something to do with the fact that you can use it to squeeze wages further, because new workers are thrown on the market who are willing to work for even less money.
Trenkenshu is technically wrong on this point. Wages are slightly up, but that doesn't mean much to people like Thorsten, who lost their jobs, or others who are barely hanging on. Meanwhile, 10,000 newcomers apply for asylum every month. Today on America Abroad, we look at the impact this massive influx of immigrants is having on countries throughout Europe, how it's fueling xenophobia and populist movements, even violent extremism. In Greece, refugee centers have been firebombed. Brexit has emboldened white supremacists in the UK. Finland is forcing many Muslim immigrants to return back to the Middle East where they face violence and persecution. But there's also active resistance to this populism in courtrooms and on the streets. While this wave of European populism is relatively new, xenophobia and discrimination against Muslim immigrants has been going on for generations. Akbar Ahmed is the chair of Islamic Studies at American University in Washington, and he's a former Pakistani ambassador to the UK. He just completed a major study of Muslim communities in Europe, and he says Muslim immigrants face assimilation problems across the continent, even second and third generation immigrants. They were born and grew up in Europe. Their first language maybe was French or German.
But they don't quite feel fully accepted So while they have the passport and legally they belong to that nation, they're not fully integrated. And the result is that in the meantime, they're cut off from their own societies. And I was told by many, many young people in Germany, in France, and so on, that when we go home, the Turks would tell me, you're German. And when these same Turks would come back to Germany, which is their home now, the Germans would say, you're Turk. So in that sense, they're suspended between two cultures.
And it's not just a sense of not belonging. They face real discrimination.
Many don't get jobs. I was told this again and again that in Germany, for example, if the Turks apply for jobs, however qualified they are, simply the fact that they have a Turkish name on their application, they will be unsuccessful in getting the job.
It's especially difficult for Muslims of Middle Eastern or African descent.
So someone with a darker skin will always be seen as instinctively as someone who's from outside society. And that always prevents them from being fully seen as local. And you're seeing that the far right, in fact, plays on this. They talk of Europe as a continent of Christians and white Christians.
He calls this European tribalism.
By European tribalism, I mean leadership, social organization, values, the memory of belonging to one people, ancestry going back to common ancestors, and one particular territory.
A national identity rooted in thousands of years of cultural history.
The danger is when this primordial identity feels threatened and feels under siege, it then can convert to predator identity. And this, by the way, is common of all societies which have a sense of a common tribal identity. And that predator identity will focus on the minority. And that's when the trouble and the problems begin.
That, says Ahmed, is what's happening now across Europe and the United States.
This kind of direction, the predatory tribal identity, it leads straight to violence, bloodshed, and misery for both the majority and the minority. And it challenges at its very core Western European modernity and humanism.
But Ahmed also says Muslim immigrants can do more to gain acceptance. And he points to another often maligned group, Jews.
Chief Rabbi Bent Melchior of Denmark. He said, first, when we came here, the Jewish community came to Denmark, the first thing we did was set up a really good school. But it wasn't to teach the Jews about Judaism. It was to teach the Jews about Danish culture, Danish history, so that they could become better Danes. Number two, he said that every minority has its rights in a society, and you're right to demand them. But every majority also has its rights, and you must acknowledge that. And we too often dismiss the demands and the rights of the majority. And number three, he said, you have to understand that in our experience, if one Jew did something wrong, our entire community would be blamed. And that's what's happening to you. And you have to understand that's how society works. So if there's one Muslim who commits terrorism somewhere in Europe or in Afghanistan or the Middle East, everyone will be blamed. Each one of you will be blamed.
Ahmed points to some progress. There are more Muslims now being elected to office.
And they're beginning to provide a new kind of leadership. So, for example, you have the mayor of London, who's highly known and respected figure in the community. You had Baroness Warsi, who's one of the senior most conservative politicians, and many, many other people like this on television, radio show hosts, television hosts, and so on. And this, in time, will encourage the communities to merge and become part of the larger society.
But since the refugee crisis began 3 years ago, it has become harder for immigrants to assimilate and harder for host countries to absorb them. And that's mainly because there are so many of them coming. Take Greece. It's just a short boat ride away from Turkey and a key gateway to the rest of Europe. More than 1 million refugees have landed in Greece since the crisis began in 2015. Lately, the country has been not so welcoming to asylum seekers. Nikki Seth Smith reports from Athens.
On the streets of central Athens today, it's pretty normal to hear Arabic, Kurdish, or Dari being spoken. Migrant centers, refugee hostels, and squats housing those in need are bursting with activity. However, a recent rise in hate crime is threatening these spaces, with a string of vigilante attacks carried out by the far right. According to the Greek police, the number of racist hate crimes nearly tripled in 2017. In March, a far-right extremist group called Krypteia, apparently a reference to ancient Sparta, attacked the office of the Afghan community in Greece in downtown Athens. Yonis Mohammadi, a former president of the centre, was one of the first at the scene of the crime.
They put a liquid, I think, on the door, and then they put it fire.
The arson attack destroyed the office and forced the community to find a new home. Yonis came here as a refugee in 2001. In 2010, he helped set up the Greek Forum of Refugees, a network that continues to support asylum seekers from all over the world, including Syria, Congo, Sudan, and Somalia.
And now lately we have more Turkish asylum seekers that they are coming here.
Since the rise in racist attacks, Yonis has been afraid that the Greek Forum of Refugees could be a target. Many civil society organizations have received death threats in the last year, including the Muslim Association of Greece. Yonis says migrant communities in Greece don't expect the police to protect them. So his organization used precious funds to install a security camera.
We don't feel safe in our offices. You go in every community there and somehow they are afraid.
It's not only migrant centers under attack. In January, in the port town of Piraeus, the Greek anti-racist group Kirfa began reporting attacks on migrant homes occurring at least three times a week. Then in April, far-right extremists on Lesvos Island descended on more than 200 Afghan asylum seekers who were protesting the conditions in the overcrowded camp, injuring around a dozen. What's behind this spike in violence? While small groups of far-right extremists are sometimes taking responsibility, the big picture leads back to one group.
The far-right Golden Dawn is busy winning hearts and minds.
Farthest out on the fringe is Golden Dawn.
Golden Dawn has risen to become Greece's third major party, despite regular reports linking it to hate crimes.
Golden Dawn is a neo-Nazi political party that first entered parliament in 2012, winning 7% of the vote. They celebrated the victory with a rally in central Athens, holding torches and waving their flag, a swastika-like symbol on a red background.
For Golden Dawn, violence is the message.
That's Antonis B., a journalist who prefers not to use his full name. Through his independent online TV station, Omnia TV, he's been reporting and speaking out against the group. In 2015, the party leadership was put on trial, accused of operating as a criminal organization. The trial's still ongoing, with 69 Golden Dawn members charged, including their 16 members of parliament and their leader, Nikolaos Mikololiakos, who they call the Führer.
We have the biggest trial in Europe after the Nuremberg trials of a National Socialist Party ever.
There's a long history in Greece of the anti-fascist movement protecting migrants and refugees from far-right extremists like Golden Dawn. And with the rise in violence, they too have become a target. In January, an anti-fascist social centre in the northern coastal city of Thessaloniki was firebombed. A month later, there was an apparent attempt to destroy the Favela Free Social Centre in the port town of Piraeus. Lawyer Eleftheria Tombadzoglu was there at the time.
During the attack, they were shouting that they are going to kill us and they're going to burn us.
She says after beating up five of the members, they left shouting the Golden Dawn slogan, Blood, Honour, Golden Dawn.
Actually, all of us needed medical care at the time.
A police investigation is underway, but no arrests have yet been made. Eleftheria is an expert on Golden Dawn. She's representing the family of Pavlos Fisas, the anti-fascist rapper allegedly stabbed to death by a Golden Dawn member in 2013. It was this incident that started the broader ongoing trial against the party. And though Eleftheria is hopeful she will win her case, she doesn't believe the judicial system can fight Golden Dawn on its own.
The only way to solve this problem is through society, through the actions people can do when are unified.
Parliamentary elections are due to be called by October of next year. The most recent opinion polls show support for Golden Dawn remaining pretty constant at 7 or 8%. The worry is that Golden Dawn members will amp up attacks in the run-up to the vote, says Yonis Mohammadi.
They are powerful, yes. And the fear is much more than what it was in 2009, 11 or 12 for us as migrants and refugees. The fear that any time if they want, they can attack.
So as Golden Dawn maintains its power base, the refugee crisis looks set to continue. The vast majority of refugees have passed through Greece to other European countries. However, many remain. In 2017, this small country received over 58,000 asylum applications. That's the highest of any EU state relative to population. The Afghan community in Greece, whose office was set on fire in March, is now working to rebuild. They found a new apartment in a central Athens block of flats, and three small rooms bustle with life. A Greek class is taking place while families wait in the other room to get help with their documentation. It took them just 2 weeks to relocate, but this time they're keeping a lower profile. There's no sign or name on the door, and members like Zahir Hidari say they don't feel safe anymore. We don't have any security, nothing here. We're back, we're continuing our work, but we only have God's help. For America Abroad, I'm Nikki Seth Smith in Athens.
Coming up, while Athens may be the gateway for Muslim asylum seekers, Germany has become the most popular destination. But 3 years after it opened its doors to more than a million immigrants, Germans are having second thoughts.
The population has some kind of feeling that the German government has lost control over who comes into the country and who cannot come into the country.
For more on this program, check out our website at PRI.org. You're listening to America Abroad. I'm Madeline Brand. This hour, backlash, Europe's far right and Muslim migration. Let's go to Germany now, a country that has welcomed more refugees in the past few years than any other European country, more than a million. But increasingly, many Germans now are wondering if that was a good idea. William Noah Glucroft reports from Berlin.
They came quickly. They came together. And they came with cultural backgrounds different from the Christian or European traditions that characterize much of Germany's previous migrant experience and Germany itself.
Germany has debated for a long time whether it's a country of immigrants or it's not a country of immigrants.
Thomas Sparrow is a political correspondent on the far right beat for DW, Germany's international public broadcaster.
Germany has debated a lot about whether it is positive that migrants come to the country or not, whether it is positive that migrants bring their own culture or not. Those are all things that here in Germany are extremely, extremely controversial. They've been extremely controversial for a very long time, and obviously now even more so as a result of the refugee crisis.
The latest flow of foreigners has reignited a fire here that had been slow burning for decades. And the biggest source of fuel for that fire, the anti-Islam Pegida movement, and their political allies, Alternative for Germany, or AfD. Originally founded by academic Euroskeptics and well-to-do conservatives, the AfD was polling in single digits before the refugees' arrival. Then Chancellor Angela Merkel, faced with a potential humanitarian disaster on Europe's doorstep, uttered three words that have come to define her 13 years of otherwise stoic leadership.
Wir schaffen das.
Wir schaffen das, which loosely translates to we can do this. Almost overnight, a migration policy formed, and the migrants came. Many Germans, especially in typically conservative Bavaria, crammed train stations to welcome the new arrivals with song and applause. But not everyone was so optimistic. Government agencies responsible for absorbing, registering, and integrating newcomers were overwhelmed. They've been accused of incompetence and even investigated for alleged corruption. Small-scale but high-profile acts of Islamic terrorism hit Germany and elsewhere in Europe, some of it linked to refugees. And certain crime statistics seem to suggest that German cities were becoming more dangerous and attributable to refugees. Nothing concrete, but enough for anti-immigrant voices like the AfD to foment doubt in German society. They've painted a picture of struggling Germans losing out to dangerous foreigners coming to steal jobs and social benefits. Or, as the AfD's parliamentary co-leader Alexander Gauland put it at a May rally in Berlin,
Es ist das Land unserer Väter und unserer Mütter, und wir wollen es behalten, wie wir es übernommen haben.
This is the land of our fathers and mothers, he said. We want to keep it the way we received it from them. An astounding statement by a man who used to be in Chancellor Merkel's ruling Conservative Party, seeing that those fathers and mothers would have belonged to the Nazi generation.
The population has some kind of feeling that the German government has lost control over who comes into the country and who cannot come into the country.
Thomas Bauer is the chairman of the Expert Council of German Foundations on Integration and Migration. His umbrella organization advises the German government on migrant policy. He says there's a lot of false information about what approved asylum seekers receive from the state and what impact they have on the economy.
Many Germans have never seen an asylum seeker face to face. But concerning income increased, welfare increased, unemployment decreased. So things actually became better, but the overall risks became bigger. And I think that's what people fear.
Fear has helped the AfD expand its ranks with Germans from across the political spectrum, from far-right activists who downplay the Holocaust to center-left working class whose economic prospects have dimmed since Germany's reunification nearly 30 years ago.
This all kind of links together. Globalization of trade, movement of people, technological revolution, which we are standing at, aging of the societies, all these things kind of move together. And it seems that people more and more go to the extreme wings of politics, be it left or be it right.
Now the AfD sits in almost every one of Germany's 16 state parliaments and captured more than 12% of the vote in last year's federal parliamentary elections. That makes them the largest party in opposition and the third largest overall.
Wir werden sie jagen.
We will hunt them down was Gauland's election night promise at AfD headquarters, and hunt her, Angela Merkel, specifically.
Wir werden uns unser Land und unser Volk zurückholen.
We will take our country and our people back, he said. Strong rhetoric. So far, it succeeded in pushing Angela Merkel's initial open door for migrants a little more closed. Her new grand coalition government is the same as the old one, with the Social Democrats, but with one big difference for refugees. There's an annual cap of 200,000 for how many can come. There's also a monthly cap of 1,000 for family reunification. And then there's the proposal to concentrate refugees in what are called anchor centers, rather than let them settle within the general population. That's something Merkel's strongly conservative sister party from Bavaria, the CSU, is pushing for. Bavaria's state elections take place this fall, and the party wants to win back those voters who jumped ship in last year's federal elections, voting for the AfD.
The tone of the debate has definitely become harsher. This makes the debate as a whole more challenging because sometimes there is less eagerness to listen to what we are seeing.
Maike Riebau is responsible for refugee migration policy for Save the Children Germany. The organization has played an active role in youth migrant absorption and integration since the beginning, both on the ground at refugee centers and at a policy level.
People seem to be less inhibited when it comes to criticism. We receive negative emails criticizing our work, people calling us criminals because we work together with refugees, so that is very concerning.
The AfD's jeers may have replaced those initial train station cheers, but the party's claims to be speaking for a majority are repeatedly challenged, both at the polls and on the streets. At the May rally in Berlin, while Alexander Gauland was telling his 5,000 supporters they needed to preserve Germany as it was, a counter-protest four times bigger had surrounded them to show Germany as it is. Thomas Sparrow, DW's AfD reporter, was there.
They were standing at one point on a bridge over the river Spree, the main river here in Berlin, and you could see on the one hand the 5,000 AfD protesters and on the other hand many of the counter-protesters, and I quickly understood there that this was a clash of visions about where Germany wants to go in the future, and also a clash of visions about whether Germany should be a more open country or whether Germany should focus on Germans and not necessarily on those who are coming to the country.
This is Germany in 2018, divided as it wrestles with its past, worries about its future, and wonders about the country's place today. For America Abroad, this is William Noah Gloucroft in Berlin.
After William filed his story, the migration issue touched off a full-blown political crisis for Chancellor Angela Merkel. A key pillar of her governing coalition, Bavaria's CSU party, is now wavering in support. Their leader has threatened to unilaterally impose border controls. The move is a bid to bolster the party's right-wing credentials before the Bavarian state elections this fall. Well, if Merkel bows to that pressure, she could lose the support of people on the left who support the refugees. And this could be the end of her tenure as chancellor and even the end of the EU's open border policy. Now to Britain, 2 years after Brexit.
The decision taken in 1975 by this country to join the common market has been reversed by this referendum to leave the EU. The British people have spoken, and the answer is we're out.
The decision has left politicians scrambling to figure out new policies. And on the streets, the vote has stirred up violence. Dasha Lisitsina has this story from London.
Nick Ryan from Hope Not Hate, an anti-fascist advocacy group, says that this new wave of far-right extremism may have been encouraged by the dangerous rhetoric around the Brexit referendum in 2016, the referendum on whether the UK should stay in or leave the European Union.
So what you had during the Brexit campaign was an unleashing of the genie's bottle, and a lot of toxic narratives came out. You had a rise in hate crimes during the campaign and immediately afterwards when we voted to leave the EU.
Leading up to the referendum, there was the infamous murder of pro-refugee politician Joe Cox by Britain's first far-right terrorist Thomas Mayer. In the year following the Brexit campaign, hate crimes increased by a third. Last year, a man called Darren Osborne drove a van into a crowd of Muslims near a mosque in Finsbury Park, London. Evidence in the trial shows that he was radicalised online by far-right groups.
The whole Brexit process really did uncork something in Britain, and it hasn't really simmered down since.
Just this May in central London, there was a so-called Day of Freedom right-wing free speech protest led by Tommy Robinson, the leader of one of the most prominent far-right groups in the UK, the English Defence League, known as the EDL. This was after Tommy Robinson, real name Stephen Yaxley Lennon, was banned from Twitter for hateful conduct. The Finsbury Park terrorist Darren Osborne was reading his incendiary online content.
He's a very well-known character here. He's got a street charisma that many in the far right have previously lacked. He's called Islam fascism. He's threatened the full force of this EDL group against Muslims if there's an attack in the UK against British citizens. He's marched close to mosques. He's cost British taxpayers about £10 million in policing costs. He has multiple convictions.
Tommy Robinson has now become a bit of a cause célèbre among the US right wing. After recently being arrested for breaching the peace outside a court trial, the Free Tommy Robinson campaign started, with the likes of Roseanne Barr and Donald Trump Jr. rallying behind him. The English Defence League traces its roots back to 2009 and the town of Luton. Located just north of London, it's best known for its football team, Luton FC, and as a hotbed of far-right and Islamic terrorism. Luton has the classic recipe for a petri dish of right-wing extremism, economic decline and a change in demographics. It's a post-industrial town that has suffered from the closure of a giant car plant and, over the past couple of decades, has become increasingly multicultural, with a big Muslim population living there. Peter Adams is a Christian community mediator and peacemaker in Luton. He works with young people in danger of being radicalised by the far right.
At one point, this was seen very much as a sort of white working class community that had been very much left behind. There was a huge amount of unemployment up here and so on.
Through social media, Peter tracked down friends of friends, sons and daughters of church members, people in youth groups who'd expressed EDL sympathetic views.
People would often say, we can't fly our flag, we can't hold up a cross, we can't claim to be Christian because of political correctness. Right from the start, we've had to spend a lot of time myth-busting and challenging those narratives. Narratives like, they're taking over, they've come over here to rape our women. You know, all extremism, all terror comes from the Muslim community. The reality is it doesn't.
Peter says the segregated geography of Luton was conducive to this far-right movement.
If you look over there, you can see Luton Central Mosque. And in the early days of the English Defence League, we got the feeling they want to draw a line. White heartland, multicultural. Lock them in. And that language was used to sort of surround them, you know, create little ghettos.
The English Defence League officially started as a result of the homecoming parade of an army regiment in 2009. They'd just been on tour in Iraq and two of them had died there. They were protested against by a small group of Muslim extremists, whom a number of people tried to beat up.
Following that march, there were other demonstrations over a period of weeks. Things began to hot up. One of the mosques was firebombed. There were racist attacks, anti-Muslim attacks.
We're a regular haunt for the far right and the far right narrative.
That's Rahana Faisal, a Muslim mother of six living in Luton. She works with Peter Adams to combat terrorism and hate crimes in their town. And she remembers her first contact with the English Defence League.
I don't live far from the town centre, and we had some stray protesters come onto our street. And my very young son, looking out of the window at that point, and one of the protesters turns at one point, looks at my son and shouts something quite offensive. And my little boy coming and asking me what that meant.
Brexit didn't create racism and anti-Islamic sentiments out of thin air. It merely exposed what had been bubbling under the surface for a while. But the xenophobic rhetoric in the campaign to leave the EU has opened the Overton window of what is acceptable to say in mainstream politics. And this has shifted the whole political discourse in the UK to the right. Nick Ryan says this strategy is still being used.
Far-right groups, particularly these ones that talk about free speech, are trying to push and push and push so you get your, what previously looked like an extreme view, more readily accepted. People get used to it.
What this kind of new wave of anti-Muslim racism has done has brought to the table a legitimised form of racism, one that they feel that is totally justified and supported by a mainstream narrative that depicts Muslims as the fifth column, the enemy within. And, you know, you will get a ton of arguments about what the Brexit vote means, but certainly we saw a xenophobic, racially charged campaign. And whether that was what people voted on, we can't say categorically, but certainly there was a strong mood, and certainly that's been reflected in the behaviour of people post-Brexit.
Though right-wing-fuelled hate crime has steadily been rising, the political landscape of the far right has changed after Brexit. Ironically, the parties that called for Brexit, UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, and the BNP, the British National Party, have lost their reason to exist after Brexit. Their aim was achieved. Rahana says their demise is also in part because these far-right parties are no longer the only ones expressing rather right-wing views.
People who support what we might previously have considered fringe, racist, xenophobic views have become mainstream.
And while the mainstream traditional far-right political parties have gradually fallen apart since Brexit, their supporter base hasn't gone away. In fact, Nick Ryan says figures like the EDL's Tommy Robinson receive support from all over the world.
So when you see street demonstrations in the UK or in Luton or wherever, it can look very localised, but actually when you pull back, you realise this is a vast network of organisations and individuals and money who are seeking to influence that anti-Muslim narrative. Now, what happens to the far-right politically after this is an open question. We could see the resurgence of a radical right, a populist movement here. So Nigel Farage, who used to lead the UK Independence Party, he's been a friend of Donald Trump, friend of Steve Bannon. He's been in discussions and openly said that he may launch a radical right party.
To prevent a further rise of right-wing extremism, Rahana says that although the community work she's doing in Luton does help in the short term, the entire mainstream narrative around immigration and Islam needs to change.
The real challenge is that this is a problem that's going to be fixed top down and not bottom up. But whilst we perpetuate a narrative from the top down, we are going to keep turning this cycle of hate and difference and divide.
One segment of the British establishment that is very concerned about the threat of the far right is the police and the courts. In the past year, 22 people have been arrested and charged for alleged membership of the outlawed Nazi terrorism group National Action. And this summer they're facing a big trial, which will set the tone for just how serious the authorities are about stopping the rise of far-right extremism in the UK. For America Abroad, this is Dasha Lisitsina in London.
Every country in Europe has been affected by the refugee crisis, even Finland, up near the Arctic Circle, wedged between Sweden and Russia. Now, after an influx of refugees, some local politicians have begun openly questioning the veracity of asylum claims.
We have a lot of asylum seekers who are really not entitled to get a place in Finland because they are not so-called real asylum seekers.
That's just ahead on the program. Are you just tuning in? You can catch the full episode and past programs by subscribing to America Abroad on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're checking out podcasts, we want to let you know about a new one produced by the team here at America Abroad. It's called Stories from the Back Channel, an insider look at great moments of diplomacy from the Center for a New American Security. Here's a quick preview.
One night, we're in the Russian Defense Ministry having a meeting with all of the generals trying to work out the terms under which the Russia and NATO will deploy again to keep the peace in Kosovo. And the next thing we know, Strobe's cell phone is ringing, and it's Sandy Berger from the National Security Advisor saying, I don't know what you're talking to the Russians about, but they have just landed forces in Pristina, and whatever they're telling you about cooperating, they're lying. You need to fix it.
You're listening to America Abroad on PRI. From PRI, it's America Abroad. I'm Madeline Brand. Tornio is a small town in northern Finland, just inside the Arctic Circle. It's right on the border with Sweden. In the summer, the sun sets after midnight. The population is tiny, just about 20,000 people. It's a quiet place with lots of pine trees. But in the summer of 2015, word spread that Finland was a good place for refugees from Iraq. So hundreds of Iraqis started arriving in Tornio every day. They crossed the border from Sweden by bus, by car, by foot. Now, though, Tornio's hospitality is wearing thin. Molly Schwartz reports.
Haitham Dagher grew up in Iraq, surrounded by sectarian fighting. He thought the Iraqi government was only making the violence worse. Haitham knew it was time to leave. He sold his car and used the money to get out of Baghdad. He made his way by boat, bus, car, and train through Turkey, Macedonia, Serbia, Austria, Germany, and Sweden. He kept going north.
And then I think Finland is a good country.
In September of 2015, he finally crossed the border into Finland, to Tornio.
I have just 20 euro on my bucket. I can't go anywhere anymore. I have to stay like in Finland, in Tornio.
So Haitham got started trying to make a life for himself in Tornio. But there were challenges. Some people weren't happy that so many refugees were arriving. The small town of Tornio turned into a hotbed of political tension. Anti-immigrant groups started staging demonstrations on the border, where the refugees arrived. People called on the government to close the border. They waved Finnish flags and chanted, "Finland is for Finns." After the refugee crisis, anti-immigrant activities in Finland got more organized and more violent. White nationalist groups started popping up. According to police reports, racially motivated hate crimes spiked by 30% after the refugee crisis. Some of the violence was caused by a group called the Soldiers of Odin. The group was founded in a town next to Tornio in October 2015, just a month after Haitham arrived. The Soldiers of Odin founder is a self-proclaimed neo-Nazi, and its members wear matching black jackets with a skull and a Viking helmet on the back. They've threatened Haitham and his friends.
If they see someone alone or like this refugee, they will hit too much, or they hit with knife or like that.
These incidents were discouraging. So was the police's lack of action to protect the refugees, says Haitham. Still, Finland felt a lot safer to him than Iraq. But to stay in Finland, Haitham needed to prove that he had valid reasons to seek asylum. Then he could get a residence permit. And a residence permit is what he needed to get permanent housing, enroll in school, and get a job, which is what Haitham wanted to do. But Haitham was only one of many asylum seekers.
In 2015, we received a total of 32,000 applicants, so we got 10 times more asylum seekers than we normally did.
This is Jana Vuorio, the Director General of the Finnish Immigration Service. She explains that the Immigration Service wasn't prepared for the massive influx of refugees that summer.
We had only 3,500 places in reception centers in Finland in June 2015, but by the end of that year, we needed places for 35,000 applicants.
Haitham's application was one in 20,000 submitted by Iraqis. It was caught up in a massive backlog. For a long time, he didn't get a response. But then, after a little over a year, it came. Asylum not granted.
What I can do, like, I can't live here and I can't leave Iraq. Where I go?
Haitham's story is far from unique. He came to Finland because he heard it was a good country for Iraqis. there's been an Iraqi diaspora in Finland since the 1990s. But when Haitham was applying, Finland was rejecting Iraqi asylum applications at a percentage rate that was twice as high as the EU average.
Recognition rate is around 40% and rejection is around 60%.
The Finnish Immigration Service grants permits based on international agreements and on the Finnish immigration law. And Finnish immigration laws became stricter after the refugee crisis.
We used to have a national protection category. It was called humanitarian protection category, so that was abolished from our law. Also, previously, if an asylum seeker didn't want to return voluntarily, but the police was unable to return him in a short period of time, so also a temporary residence permit could be granted. So those were removed from our law. So it means that more applicants were refused, and that also has, of course, caused frustration.
As more refugees came in, there was more political pressure to tighten the immigration laws. The same tensions that were making people march on the border in Tornio were playing out in Finnish politics. In 2015, a nationalist populist political party called the Finns Party gained 17.7% of the vote. That was enough to become part of the majority coalition in the Finnish parliament.
My name is Mika Raatikainen, member of parliament, and I represent the Finns Party. I have been member of the parliament in Finland now for 4 years.
The Finns Party campaigned on a platform of limiting immigration.
We welcome immigration as long as it's beneficial for Finland and the people who are coming here. They really want to go by the Finnish rules and they are willing to work or study. We don't really want to have any like free passengers who just come here and enjoy our pretty good social services.
Raatikainen doesn't believe that all the recent immigrants deserve legitimate refugee status.
We have a lot of asylum seekers who are really not entitled to get a place in Finland because they are not so-called real asylum seekers. They have some other agendas why they are here, and that's why quite a few of them are returned back to their home country.
When the Finns Party became part of the majority coalition, they were able to get pieces of their agenda into the government's strategic program. This included tightening the flow of immigrants into Finland.
We have made it a little bit stricter.
So now fewer refugees are arriving. But what happens to the refugees who are already there?
Some of them have returned back to Iraq because the war is more or less over there.
The Finnish government has declared Iraq safe enough for refugees to return. They're paying to fly refugees back to Baghdad. About 5,000 Iraqis who came to Finland during the crisis have now returned to Iraq. While many have left voluntarily after getting rejected, others are being deported.
There's about 500 now waiting deportation, according to the police.
So that leaves over 10,000 Iraqi refugees who are like Haitham, still in Finland but without status and without a permit. It's a weird state of limbo. Haitham is living now in Oulu with his girlfriend, a Finnish woman named Satu.
We wait too much, it makes stress for us and it's coming a little bit bad.
Haitham has applied a second time for asylum, but he isn't optimistic. Everyone he knows who applied for asylum a second time has received a second negative response. But this time, there's something different about Haitham's application. He's converted from Islam to Christianity. Changing his religion might help Haitham get a residence permit. When he was a Shia Muslim, he was part of the religious majority in Iraq. But as a Christian, he would be in the religious minority. And that would make him at risk of religious persecution if he were to return to Iraq. This could help him qualify for asylum. So despite the rise in hate crimes, Haitham sees a future for himself here in Finland. And he hopes that Finland will soon feel the same way about him. For America Abroad, I'm Molly Schwartz.
All this hour, we've been looking into the rise of nationalism and the effect that it's had on Muslim communities in Europe. Vikram Singh is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's here to tell us more about this idea of nationalism. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
Great to have you. Okay. Your organization has put out a report that uses the term authoritarian populism. And I'm just wondering if first you can define what you mean by that. What is authoritarian populism?
So one of the reasons we focused on this, and this was a joint project between the Center for American Progress, which is a left-of-center progressive organization, and the American Enterprise Institute, which is a big conservative think tank here in Washington. We cooperated on this together because we were basically concerned not about populism. This word gets thrown around a lot. Populism itself may be good or may be bad. I mean, it's about appealing to the desires of the citizens and the constituents. But authoritarian populism was the phrase we chose for populists who tend to move in an anti-democratic direction. And it's a phenomenon that we've been seeing across Europe, the United States, really across democracies worldwide. We see it as an area in which people who believe in democratic values, whatever their politics or views on a given issue, should really stand firm and say, we stand for equality before the law, independent judiciaries, freedom of the press. We need to think about how important those things are, and we need to rally behind those as patriotic causes.
And are these leaders doing this with an ultimate goal in mind, or are they doing it because they see that it immediately works to rile up their base?
I think it depends on the leader. So I think some leaders are thinking, this is a good way for me to secure the extreme part of my base. And the ones who, for whom it's more just a tool of convenience, will probably not pursue disturbingly anti-democratic policies when they get into office. But I think it exposes a tendency. If you're willing to go there, if you're willing to cross those lines, if you're willing to vilify other people based on their religion, their ethnicity, whatever it may be, you're probably not particularly respectful of democratic institutions. And so, you know, what starts as a campaign tactic turns into a philosophy of governance.
Is the basis for all of this economic insecurity?
The answer to that is yes and no. So one of the debates that we pretty quickly decided we weren't going to come down on one side or the other of is this idea. It's like, okay, everybody's racist and therefore they are drawn to these extreme figures, or everybody's out of a job and is economically insecure and that's why they're drawn to these more extreme voices. And the fact is, it looks like it's really a complex interplay of the two. So they're connected.
Where is this not happening? I mean, we've seen this rise of authoritarian populism across Europe. There must be holdouts or countries that are experiencing population shifts and economic anxiety, but are not seeing this response.
So, you know, I hate to say that I actually don't see very many places where it's not happening at all. So even places that we wouldn't say are going to an extreme have seen politicians turning to the nationalist and populist playbook. So even leaders like Narendra Modi in India or Abe in Japan have used a lot of nationalist appeals. You know, what we see is a lot of what the impact will or will not be once people use those tools and come into power is how strong the institutions are. So countries with really established democratic institutions, strong courts, a strong independent press, they're less likely to allow abuses to take place even when they have a populist leader in power. I think that's thus far seemed to be the case in the United States, where although President Trump tends to yell at the fake news and say they should be in jail and his political opponent should be in jail and the FBI and the Justice Department are, he attacks them as being colluding against him and things like that, we don't see these institutions caving or falling apart. So that seems to be one of the factors. If you look at Western versus Eastern Europe, democracy is much younger in Eastern Europe, and it seems like there is a tendency that in those younger democracies, it's harder for the institutions to withstand the onslaught of an authoritarian populist leader. But there's a whole new, you know, brave new world of online media and how things can be manipulated and how algorithms, you know, raise the more sensational, horrible stuff in your feed and things like that, that overall I think has not been helpful, but could be helpful down the road.
Well, speaking of prescriptions, you have some recommendations for ways that moderate voices can fight back in this report. What are some of the key findings?
One thing is that we do think that mainstream parties have sort of missed the boat. They watch themselves get overtaken in engagement, in voter outreach. That's one thing. We think you need to really take on board concerns of the voters, even if you're not comfortable with them. So the fact is, in Europe, people are worried about refugees. And in the United States, people are worried about illegal immigration. You know, we laughed about the fact that we put a phrase like, do not be condescending, into a report. But do not be condescending. I mean, there has to be a back and forth and a sense that people can ask questions and can have different views without fearing that they'll be labeled as racist or uninformed, things like that. And then finally, like, there's no reason that a positive, affirmative vision that's rooted in democratic values can't be emotionally resonant and have heart. I think more centrist figures who figure out how to resonate with their voters are going to stand a much better chance and are going to be able to put a contrast between them and extreme populists or authoritarian populists that will be welcomed by a lot of voters.
Well, I want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much.
That's Vikram Singh. He's a senior fellow for national security at the Center for American Progress. We've seen this before, the combination of economic uncertainty and immigrants stirring up fear, fear of the unknown, really, fear that the future will be different and worse. For many, it already is worse, worse for them and worse for their children. The question is, who and what will make it better? And the answer for many here and in Europe is populism. Populism is defined as supporting the concerns of ordinary people. Well, those concerns can be supported, or they can be exploited. This Hour of America Abroad was written and edited by Rob Sachs and produced by Shoshi Shmulevitz, with additional production help from Flan Williams, Alyssa Moxley, and Mari Karpinen. Nolan Schneider provided our theme music and assisted with sound design. Audio engineering support was provided by Phil Richards at KCRW. You can hear past programs by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes, finding us on the Public Radio International app, or by visiting our website, PRI.org, where you can also find extended interviews and exclusive content pertaining to this and other programs. I'm Madeline Brand, and this is America Abroad from Public Radio International. Support for this show was provided by the Henry Luce Foundation, Public Radio International stations, and listeners like you.
PRI, Public Radio International.